This is the Thanks for Sharing podcast, the podcast where we explore all things recovery, healing, and relationship.
Remember, you can subscribe and download episodes in the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, or on the Podbean app. And you can find more Thanks for Sharing at www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/healingpaths. That's paths with an S. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Thanks for Sharing. I'm Jackie P.
I'm John T.
Today, we're going to be talking about why am I not getting it?
And I'm excited about this episode because I get to nerd out a little bit on neurology and the brain. And I think this has real life application to recovery. We actually, a lot of the work we do in our practice has to do with why am I not getting it and looking below the brain for
right.
the answer there.
Right. But before we jump into why am I not getting it and start talking about all of that nerdy stuff, we wanted to first, again, plug the Making Friends with Anger webinar that's coming up.
So that's coming up on, it's a four-part webinar, and it starts on February 13th at 7:30 p.m. This is for any kind of issues that you have with anger. Maybe you don't do anger well.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you do anger way too well and don't do other emotions well.
Maybe you think you don't have anger, which means you're completely unaware.
Right. So this is really going to focus on some good education, good information, really solid skills for greeting anger with skill, and hopefully giving you a jump start in working on anger in your recovery.
Yeah. I've had a couple of people, my clients, that have gotten the email about it, and they've responded. A couple of them have actually registered right on the spot, which is always great. But a couple of them responded and said, was this made just for me?
Yeah. and I will say it was made just for every client we work with because
yes.
anger is such a big issue in recovery. So if you want to register for that, you can go to johntaylorlcsw.com. That's johntaylorlcsw.com and register for that class. I also need to make an amends for our last episode. You've noticed we've done some work on our intro and outro to the episode because we didn't feel like it flowed well.
Yeah.
And so, of course, at the end of last episode, I made it as awkward as possible going into the outro. So listen carefully because I'm going to try not to do that today.
Yeah, hopefully you didn't just jinx you or me.
Probably we'll did. Probably did. This will be a hilarious train wreck.
Okay, so let's get into our topic today. Why am I not getting it?
Yeah, so we wanted to start today by talking about something called polyvagal theory. And I would not recommend going and Googling this and reading all of the research articles. It's really dense research. It's
right.
hard to understand. So we're going to talk about the very basics of it and why we feel like it's pretty critical in addiction recovery. So polyvagal theory refers to the polyvagal nerve, and there's actually two of those that go from the brain down into the body. And these nerves control connection between the brain and the body, and their primary focus, if you can say nerves have a primary focus, their primary focus is on safety. So these nerves become really activated when you're not feeling safe.
Mm.
And the way that they're wired to the brain, they will override every other structure of the brain. We like to think that our frontal cortex is where the power is at in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
I always say if there's going to be a battle between your body and your brain is going to lose every time. And it's because of this polyvagal nerve,
right.
Which is going to help you do fight, flight, or freeze when there's danger. So that's why it's called polyvagal theory, because it has to do with this. And an interesting fact about the polyvagal nerve, it is not myelinated. And myelin is like this fatty sheath that goes around nerves that helps conduct those electrochemical impulses faster. So the polyvagal nerve is a slow nerve. Information doesn't flow as quick as, say, the neurons in your brain. So when we're working to calm things and get the body and the brain on the same page, it's going to take more time. It's not as quick as a process.
And I'm guessing, I don't know this, so I'm kind of guessing, but I'm also asking, do you know, maybe you don't know either, when it says it's more of a slow process, I'm guessing that's still pretty quick.
Yeah. Like we're talking hundreds of a second.
Okay.
But I think the overall idea when we start talking to our clients about getting into their bodies first and doing calming there before they try to get thoughts online, a lot of them will come back and say, well, I took a couple deep breaths and that didn't change anything. Mm. And it's more like research would indicate more like 20 minutes of working on calming the body is about what you need
okay.
to get back into that window of tolerance. So I don't know if the myelination directly has anything to do with that, but I thought that was an interesting fact because in my experience, the process of calming the body is a lot slower than switching the thoughts.
Yeah. Well, and I will tell clients sometimes, and this kind of goes along with the polyvagal theory, like I think whether it's the brain or the body, rule number one is protect the asset.
Yeah.
And the asset is always the person.
Yeah.
And so if there's a perceived danger, that rule goes into effect. You know, it's protect the asset.
And I think the key there is the perception.
Yes.
Because a lot of times when we'll have people reacting, like their body is totally doing fight or flight, and they'll say, like, I don't know why I'm doing this.
Uh-huh.
That perception isn't always conscious.
Well, and there's not a difference between emotional safety and physical safety.
Right, right. Or imagined threat and real threat. The brain doesn't distinguish between the two.
So I may be, you know, kind of walking down the street late at night and hear kind of a crack behind me,
mm-hmm.
like a noise, snapping of a twig or something. My brain perceives danger.
Yeah.
Like maybe somebody's walking up behind me. Now I may turn around and see a cat or something like that. And my system can pretty quickly calm down. Like, okay.
Right.
Danger averted. But my body still responds and I uh-huh. might still have some chemicals in my body mm-hmm. flowing because my body initially went into what's happening. There's danger. I may have to fight or run, something like that.
Yeah. And some of that residual chemicals in the body, like you talked about, even after you notice it's a cat, like you might shake for a while.
Right.
Or you might be jumpy for a while, even though you're consciously realizing there's not a threat, your body is still processing through that. And it takes some time for the body to calm down again.
Yeah. Okay.
Because the body is not going to be caught off guard. Especially if you've been triggered once, your body's not going to immediately, you know, go to sleep and totally relax. You're going to be on alert for a little while, even if the brain is saying it's all safe. Cause I think, we like to think our perceptions are always completely accurate and right on. Memory and perceptions are notoriously, faulty. They can be manipulated. And I think part of that brain and body connection is the body's not fooled, quote unquote, fooled as easily. And so the body's going to stay on high alert just to make sure that things are okay. So when we're talking about this, and we're going to loop around to how this relates to not getting it and kind of feeling trapped in that. So we talk a lot about the window of tolerance, and I don't remember if when we had Anastasia on, if we talked about the window of tolerance much.
I don't think we did.
This is a pretty handy concept to understand what's going on in your nervous system and in your body and why it might be hard to learn new information or exchange ideas. So the window of tolerance refers to this window between hyperarousal, which means like fight or flight, adrenaline, kind of pump you up.
Yeah, like I'm over-aroused.
Right, yeah, over-aroused. Thank you. That's so much simpler. it's between over-arousal and hypo-arousal, which is under-arousal, which is kind of that rest, digest, shut down, freeze response. A little bit of stress is good. We need that. Too much stress is too much. And so this window is where we kind of have this natural up and down. We can fill ups, we can fill downs without getting stuck on in too aroused or stuck off in not aroused.
And not aroused, yeah.
The key thing is when we're out of the window of tolerance, no new learning can take place.
So whether you're under aroused or over aroused, if you're out of the window of tolerance, the brain doesn't really bring in new information.
Yeah, it will run more, I think, on autopilot, like past expectations, past experiences, rather than, I know Anastasia talked a lot about updating the nervous system, rather than here's new information, here's new circumstances, I can combine all that. That takes, your brain has to feel safe to do that. And that safety's in the window of tolerance.
Yeah. So being able to bring in new information for the brain is kind of like a luxury.
Yes.
Things are going well. We're safe, so it's okay to learn.
Yeah, and you know, as you're talking about that, I'm thinking of clients that I've worked with whose nervous systems have not updated in 40 years. Like, they still respond as if they were 4 years old and in the relationship they were in with dysfunctional or abusive parents. So when you say, like, assimilating new information is a luxury, it's totally a luxury. Mm-hmm. You can survive for decades without updating that.
Yep. Not very well.
Yeah. All it is survival. It's not living.
Right, right.
Let's talk a little bit about some of our experiences, kind of in general, some of our experiences working with clients and why this window of tolerance idea is important in recovery.
Okay. So I had a thought before I have any thought. I don't have any thoughts right now about particular experiences. But one of the thoughts that I did have is just to talk about how normal it is in the therapy process to get stuck at some point.
Yes.
And probably more than once.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is because we're trying to get, maybe another way to say this is we're trying to get stuff that's in the unconscious, but it's stored in the body,
mm-hmm.
but we don't really have a working awareness around it.
Mm-hmm.
And in therapy, we're trying to move the stuff from the unconscious into the conscious.
Yeah.
Because it's in the conscious that we can ascribe meaning, update the nervous system, make choices that are informed and accurate. And so that's kind of a big deal that we're trying to do in mm-hmm. therapy, and mm-hmm. not surprising that it's not always going to just streamline really well.
Well, and I think it doesn't streamline because the unconscious is unconscious for a reason.
Yeah.
Like we locked it away and distanced ourselves from those memories for a reason. So we're really trying to connect with pain, and we're really trying to connect with trauma.
And which we've spent years and decades avoiding.
Yeah.
And now we're doing the opposite, saying go into it,
mm-hmm.
where we've been living by this rule of stay as far away as possible from it.
We've really spent decades defending against it. And the reason we go into that is not like that, hey, no pain, no gain type of a thing. It's more like that, this has started to go bad. This has started to cause problems. So we need to bring that up. We need to process it so that the past isn't ruling the present anymore.
Yeah.
You know, Jackie and I do a lot of marital sessions together, and usually...
With our spouses.
Not with our sessions, no. Maybe we should think about that.
That might be fun. No, where you and I are the therapists of the marital couple, so maybe I'm working with him and you're working with her, or vice versa, and then all four of us are in the room for a marital session.
Yeah, so when we start working with couples... over the years that we've done this, our premise has become, we want to get you out of the content, which is the words, which is where a lot of couples want to be. Like, let's hash this issue out and get a resolution. And we need to get you into the process, which is...
Or I also find, you know, in the content, a lot of times it's hashing out, but really what they want to know is who's right and who's wrong.
Yeah. I call it the game of find the bad guy.
Okay.
Which makes for really unproductive marital sessions, because it's not a matter of who's right or wrong,
or
who did things. Like, really what we're looking for in relationships, which is what recovery is, teaching us how to be relational, is can I regulate in the presence of another person?
Uh-huh.
Can I know what it feels like to be with someone who's safe enough to regulate with? And can I know what it feels like to have boundaries with someone who's not safe enough to regulate with?
It reminds me, several years ago, maybe five or maybe more, there was a TV show, and I can't even remember the name of it. It was something like The Wedding Challenge or something like that. I don't remember. And Jerry Seinfeld it was like a game show.
Oh, yeah. He was like the judge?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he'd usually have some other comedians who would come on. And, you know, so Jerry Seinfeld, comedians, it's going to, you know, hilarity's going to ensue. But they'd get this marital couple who was having an issue in their marriage, and it was usually somewhat benign. I mean, they weren't trying to do therapy in any way, and so it might be like one of them was like the wife wanted him to get rid of his lazy boy recliner, and he loved his lazy boy recliner, and they had been fighting about this for years, and so they bring this, and you know, there's a couple rounds, and the comedians ask different questions, and they get information, and you know, they're doing their comedic thing, and it's funny, and then at the end of it, they all vote. And Jerry Seinfeld his vote counts more than anybody else's, so he could trump anybody. But at the end of it, like, they voted, and so there was an identified winner and an identified loser. And I remember watching that show, and it was kind of funny, but I remember at that time thinking, that's what a lot of couples want me to do.
Yeah.
And that's not what we do.
Yeah.
And there's a reason, because, you know, I mean, yeah, it makes for great TV comedy, maybe, if we're talking about Lazy Boy recliners. And that's the extent of the issue. But for us, we're really learning about how to be with each other.
Mm-hmm.
We're learning how to be an individual and then how to take that into relationships.
Yeah. You know, when you're talking about that winner and loser thing, I think of what's going on below the neck, right? What's happening mm-hmm. in the body. And for a lot of the couples we work with, they came from homes where there were winners and losers, and there was a lot of because I said so,
yeah.
or you're wrong, or don't feel that way.
Which a lot of times that means the parents were going to be the winners.
Uh-huh.
And so they came to associate authority or power with the winning role.
Uh-huh.
And kind of being vulnerable, or for a kid, maybe more weak or younger, would be the loser.
Yeah. And so a lot of the couples that come in to see us, I would say the vast majority of them are committed to each other
mm-hmm.
and they do love each other and they want to work things out. That's what's going on in their head.
Right.
Their body is 5 years old and they experience their partner as this overpowering, domineering parent who's looking for a winner or a loser. So
yeah.
they're either on the war path or they're curled up in the corner, figuratively uh-huh. speaking, waiting for the blows to fall.
Right.
And that we can see in relationships, that's a big sticking point for a lot of couples, is our bodies are actually having this battle that we don't even realize is going on. So we're rehashing the same arguments or the same issues with the same words in the same way.
Uh-huh.
And we're getting the same resolution. And we've never checked in first to say, how safe do I actually feel talking to you?
Right. And that's, you and I have been in sessions before where if we were just reading a script of what was being said,
mm-hmm.
it sounds great.
Yeah.
It sounds like they're communicating well because the words are making sense. They're using the right words, but the feeling in the room is completely different.
Yeah. Those are always fascinating to me. And I think it took me a long time as a therapist to start tuning into that.
Uh-huh.
'Cause before I was very content oriented, right? Like, mm-hmm. oh, you guys are saying the right thing. Like, and yeah, sometimes hard feelings ensue. Right.
And then we're surprised when we meet with them again and they come back and say, yeah, after that session, we got in a big fight. And we're like, how did that happen?
But you were communicating.
Right. And that's where sometimes I will also tell clients when they come in and they say, we don't know how to communicate. I always am like, that's bullshit.
Yeah.
We know how to communicate as human beings. Like, we communicate. And that's where I'm like, my guess is you don't know what to do with what you're communicating.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm guessing your wife or your husband doesn't have to say a word and you know exactly
yep.
what's going on. So this isn't really a communication problem in terms of, like, we don't know how to use the right words kind yeah. of thing.
And I think that's expanding that awareness that communication is probably more about what's going on in the bodies than
yeah.
what's being said.
Yep.
And that's where this window of tolerance polyvagal theory thing comes in. When our body is so shut down because we're experiencing attack, whether that attack's actually going on or our body's reliving
uh-huh.
some traumatic memory, or our body is geared up to do the attacking, we aren't really experiencing the person sitting with us. We may be experiencing our parents, or we may be experiencing a previous relationship. Uh-huh. And that polyvagal nerve, when you, we haven't mentioned this yet, right? I found a really dorky YouTube video.
Oh, right.
The Polyvagal Blues. I'm going to put the link up in the show notes. And it talks about how, unfortunately, they were very gender biased on this. Miss Polyvagal is obsessed with safety, and if she doesn't feel okay, nothing's going to happen for Mr. Neocortex. But
so we have the scared girl and then the wise man.
Right.
Great. Okay.
So it's more up there for your entertainment. even though it's not really entertaining. I just thought it was ridiculous. Anyway, when the nervous system is not experiencing safety, words don't matter. Mm. And that's where I think we see a lot of our clients and a lot of people in recovery saying, I keep getting back to this point, and they'll try to think through it.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I said. This is what I did. They may even get to hear some patterns,
mm-hmm.
but until they start realizing what that does to the body and how that feels mm-hmm. in the body, and they start being able to distinguish in the body past from present,
yeah,
they're going to be stuck.
That's making me think of the episode we did recently in our What's Missing series about, was it about anger or fighting or something, where we were talking about, and I mentioned how I've had this experience with a couple of clients where, you know, I did something that you know, in the one where I just missed an appointment, and I forgot to tell them that I wasn't going to be able to be at that appointment. And I apologized, but they didn't hear those words.
Yeah.
And that happens where I had repeatedly said the words, I had taken accountability, I had owned my mistake. I had told them, I'm really sorry that that happened. I had even been able to say, I bet that made you feel, fill in the blank, abandoned. I bet that made you feel unimportant, forgotten. I'm so sorry that that happened, right? I said all of the right words, but the words didn't matter because what they were in a feeling state, not a hearing state.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that happens even outside of relationships. Like I think of people that we've worked with who have patterns at work, like they'll lose jobs consistently mm-hmm. or have a problem holding a job. And as we've dove into that, like they go to work with a lot of insecurity. I'm not good at what I do. Or I don't know what I'm doing. I'll never know what I'm doing. And I think when their nervous system is that dysregulated, they can't show up and work to their ability because they're so scared about failing, or they're so scared about getting it wrong.
Uh-huh.
And I think that happens for recovering people in a lot of situations outside of relationships.
Yeah.
Like you show up to work, or you show up to a meeting, or show up to wherever, and you're not your adult self anymore. You've suddenly time warped and you're 5 years old again. And those are the neurological coping skills that you have.
Yeah.
It's that get small, defend, protect, not really engaging and making things change.
Well, and I've had clients where that experience has happened to them, and then they start talking about, like, why couldn't I do this? Why didn't I do that? Right? Like, why? I know in my head, in my brain, what to do, what to say, but I couldn't do it. Right? And that's because what was going on in the body was, again, that what you said at the beginning of the show, where if there's a war between the brain and the body's going to win.
Mm-hmm.
And so it didn't matter. Like, yes, you know all of that in your brain to do that, but that's higher order functioning. That's kind of some left brain stuff. And if the right brain gets overwhelmed, which is the emotional stuff, what is happening in the body, the left brain can be rendered, you know, frozen or useless.
Yeah. And I've kind of along those lines, I've thought for a long time our emotions are like a sixth sense, and they're probably more accurate than our other senses.
Mm-hmm.
Which, when we realize that in recovery and kind of unlock that power, that's a great asset. Before then, it can be a bit of a liability, because sometimes our emotions are very overwhelming, or sometimes mm-hmm. what our emotions are telling us about a situation is not pretty. It's disturbing. Mm-hmm. And so if you're going to do some work on getting unstuck, or I need to get to this new level of understanding because I'm not getting it, really tuning into what the emotions are saying on a regular basis is critical.
Well, and I think this is where sometimes our prefrontal cortex gets in our way.
Yep.
Because we start to feel something, and maybe we're aware of that, but then our prefrontal cortex says, well, that's not right.
Yeah.
You shouldn't feel that. Stop that.
And that's always so interesting when I'm talking to someone and they'll come in and say, I had a big emotional crash. And I'll start asking, like, okay, how'd that happen? How long did it last? What did it feel like? And then I'll get back to, like, can you notice anything that triggered that? And at first it's always like, no, it came out of the blue. And then we'll start slicing that thinner, and we'll start talking, and they can pinpoint, like, oh, this happened and my body started to react. And I'll ask them, like, how long was your body reacting before you started thinking about this? And usually they'll say, like, it wasn't immediate. Like, I was feeling off for a while until I started to crash. And, you know, some of that recognition that our body's going to be picking up and responding to things before our brain does. And I think in a lot of cases, there's this grace period, right?
Where
you're not totally derailed. But when we ignore, we don't know how to tune into that, it really gets louder and louder. And so it's overwhelming.
And sometimes I'll have clients call that, like, I feel lost right now.
Yeah.
Like, what did you say? Or what? Like, they're in that, that kind of that gap where something's going on physiologically for them. Something's going on in the body. But they're still trying to carry on a conversation, but they're getting lost.
Yeah.
And they don't know what to say, or they'll start to be like, I don't know what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. What did you ask me?
Mm-hmm.
That's usually like, oh, we've just started to go into the body piece. And so let's just go there.
Yeah.
Like, tell me what's going on. What are you noticing in your body?
Which is counterintuitive for a lot of people.
Right.
I think a lot of people have that end goal in mind, is I just need to communicate effectively and then you'll understand, or I need to get this done and then I won't have to worry about it anymore.
Well, I think we've been conditioned, you know, and that's a whole other conversation about, you know, what's happening in the body, like, just ignore that, suppress that. We don't say, go in there and get that. And so that's where, you know, sometimes telling clients, like, if you feel it, it matters.
Yeah.
Because, you know, their higher order brain will say, well, you shouldn't feel that.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes I'll use the example and say to clients, like, I mean, do you do that, like, if you're thirsty?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, if you're at work and you drink some water and 10 minutes later you want to drink more water, do you go through that process of saying, like, why would I want to drink more water? I just drank water 10 minutes ago. I don't deserve to be thirsty again. Why didn't the drink 10 minutes ago work? What's wrong with me that I would be thirsty again? Like, for the most part, we just kind of go with that instinct of, I want water.
Yeah.
And so I drink more. And we don't get caught up in the analyzation of all of this.
Whether it's right or wrong to want water.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We just say, I feel like drinking. And I, you know, take some sips and I'm like, okay, great. And I keep going with what I'm doing. But when it comes to some of the emotional stuff that's happening in the body, we kind of dig in our heels.
Yeah. Really, like, protect and disconnect.
Yeah.
So I think it's pretty critical in that getting unstuck to start making friends with some of those emotions, like getting accustomed to them a little bit. I think one of my favorite grounding things I've heard of, and I've done this with clients, Bessel van der Kolk, in his book, The Body Keeps the Score, talks about using a beach ball in sessions, particularly when I have someone, there are times where I'll have clients, I can come in and I can tell that they are behind a wall of rage. Like, you can just feel that energy. And early on in my career, I used to push through that. Like, we'll be fine. Ignore the emotions.
Yeah.
Like, hello, family of origin story. And as I've gotten better, as I've gotten better at my job, when I have clients coming in behind that wall of emotion, I keep an inflated beach ball by my chair. And I'll say, we're just going to touch the beach ball while we're talking. And even just engaging that body, the catch, throw, and the rhythm, that's a soothing thing.
Yeah.
And that will help that polyvagal nerve to relax its grip on the brain and the body and let things flow again.
Yeah.
And I find once we've attended to the body through that use of sense and that use of rhythm and that use of relationship, we can engage the mind a lot better.
Yeah. I remember when I was like a teenager living at home, I sometimes would spend hours in my room just shuffling cards. Mm-hmm. I would get a deck of cards and I would just sit and shuffle them. I actually became pretty good at shuffling cards and doing the bridge and the whole thing. And I remember what, you know, my kids one time were like, Mom, why are you so good at shuffling cards? And I was like, oh, I used to spend hours doing this. And, you know, and they were like, why?
There was no Netflix, sweetie.
Right. And that was one of the first times I was like, why did I? I don't know why. Who would think to do that? And I think, you know, as I learned more about recovery, learned more about the emotions and the body, I realized I was soothing.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't even, like, one of my kids was like, did you play solitaire? And I was like, no, usually just shuffling cards. Like, almost like playing that game was too much.
Uh-huh.
And so I just was going through those motions of shuffling the cards in order to soothe and calm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say that's the best part of cards is the shuffle. Like, that's a very
sensory. Yeah, the sound.
It's rhythmic.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say if I had any advice on getting unstuck, I'd say start getting into your senses and finding out what's going on in your body. Mm-hmm. And see if you can shift that just a little bit through the use of senses. Yeah.
And I would add to that what we were talking about earlier, give permission for it.
Yeah.
You know, let's stay out of critiquing and just observing.
Yeah.
So if you're feeling it, it matters. If it's there, it should be.
Yeah.
And so then let's just start to notice what's there.
And it's interesting when you said that, get out of critiquing and criticizing and just observe. I've observed with myself and the people I work with, when we get to that place where we can just start observing what's happening in the body, and we can really almost like disengaging the mind,
uh-huh,
and just feeling the body, it's very rare that I'll get somebody who will say, like, and that's wrong. Mm. They'll usually start, oh, I feel this, and that actually makes sense, mm-hmm, or that feels accurate.
They get unstuck.
Yeah. Yeah. So experiment with that. Let us know how it goes. You can contact us through our Facebook page. And we want you to remember that your story matters. Remember there's something meaningful in every chapter. And don't wait to share your story till it's finished.
Share your story with us on Facebook, on our Facebook page, Healing Paths, Inc., or on our website at www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com.
Thanks, and we'll be back next week. This podcast is solely for the purpose of information and entertainment and does not constitute therapy, nor should it replace competent professional help.
At the end of another episode, we want to remind you that nobody has time for perfection. We are pursuing progress.
Remember the prayer of the perfectionist. Help me remember I can't do it all. Help me to take things one step at a time, and that the only step I need to focus on is the next right step for me.
Help me to remember that life is a journey. Help me to be able to separate all that I'm learning from all that I have to do. Help me to remember that I am not alone, that I can ask for help. Help me to strive for frequent awakenings, not mastery. I am enough. Amen.